Hello and welcome in.
Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. My guest today studies those things that creep. And if you know your Greek, you'll realize I'm talking about herpetology. That's the study of frogs, toads, newts, snakes, lizards, crocodilians, turtles, terrapins, and even worm lizards. Jeff Stryker is a curator in the herpetology department in the Natural History Museum in London, and will be talking to us today about everything from good old-fashioned specimen collection all the way through to the way modern molecular biology is changing the way we do research on the herptiles. Welcome, Jeff. So, welcome to the show, and let's get the really important question out of the way first. Do you have a favorite species in amongst those you study?
That's a hard question, but it's a bit like picking your favorite song, I think.
Yeah, or your favorite child, or something like that. Really hard.
I spend quite a lot of time thinking about this one group of frogs that lives in North and South America. They're called direct developing frogs, and so they're a bit different from what most people think of as an amphibian. You know, most people think of a, you know, amphibian, half of your life in water, half of your life on land. And these particular frogs have foregone that half of life in the water, so they don't have as much of a biphasic life cycle as most amphibians.
So then, like, not really a tadpole.
So the tadpole stage, if there's anything like it, happens inside a terrestrial egg, and so they kind of hatch out there. And one of them that I've spent a lot of time working on is something called a barking frog. And so that, if I had to pick a frog that I think about a lot, not necessarily my favorite, it would be that one.
A barking frog. Wow, that's pretty cool. We'll have to find a track of a barking frog, and we'll play it a bit later.
Cool.
Miriam. Hello, you're producing today, and you have a brain teaser for us, which is more of a question, general knowledge, but we're going to go with that instead.
So good morning, Science Mixers. Today's brain teaser is, what family does an axolotl belong to? So I'll repeat that one more time. What family does an axolotl belong to? So if you think you know the answer, then tweet us at Science Mixtape, and we'll give you a shout out at the end of the show.
Yeah, the axolotl. We had Simon Watt on a few weeks ago with the Ugly Animal Appreciation Society, and we chose our mascot, and we chose the axolotl as the Science Mixtape mascot.
Did you really?
Yeah,
so that's fantastic.
So that's our mascot. Okay, so Jeff, we're going to kick things off with the first song you've chosen. You've chosen Chon with Water Slide. Why did you choose this?
So I chose this because it's fresh in my mind. I just went to see this band play in Islington earlier this week, and I've played guitar since I was about 13, so I enjoy a bit of guitar-centric music, and I think you'll hear that this is
definitely that. This is Chon with Water Slide.
Snakes evolved from a four-legged reptilian ancestor. Some snakes, such as pythons and boas, still have traces of back legs.
Ah, so snakes. Snakes are definitely in this group, but you're a creator of herpetology at the Natural History Museum. For the uninitiated, what does that cover, and what do you do specifically?
Yeah, so herpetology, like you mentioned in the beginning of the recording, it includes amphibians and reptiles, but only certain reptiles. So it's kind of an interesting group, what's classically thought of as herpetology. So it's a specialized focus on certain animals, but a lot of the reptiles we look at they have some living relatives, the birds, that I don't study, but probably I should from an evolutionary perspective. So herpetology as a discipline kind of has some historical hangovers from when amphibians and reptiles, non-bird reptiles like snakes, lizards, crocodiles, and turtles were thought to be crawling things, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show. One of the reasons it's kind of stuck, why we still do that even though we study everything from an evolutionary perspective now, is because a lot of the methods we use to find these animals in the field, to study them in the laboratory, and to work with their genes, like we'll talk about in a little bit, are very similar when you apply them to snakes, lizards, frogs, salamanders, and animals like
that. So the grouping itself is kind of a hangover from historically what was all studied together.
Right, yeah.
And now we have a better understanding of what's related to what, we might actually divide up slightly differently.
Sure, absolutely. And it's given us great new insights in terms of why the anatomy of reptiles has evolved the way that it has versus amphibians and things like that, for sure. And in terms of what I do at the museum, so I'm in charge of the herpetology collection. And so along with my colleagues there, we take care of about 200,000 specimens. We spend time also hosting visiting researchers from all over the globe that come to collect data from our collection. And also we do a bit of training as well with a lot of local universities here in London.
Okay, so people come to the university and they do research there, and you kind of host them, and they're able to use the specimens and use the research that you do at the university.
Absolutely. Most of the students work out of the museum. So even though their degree comes from the university, they spend most of their time behind the scenes at the museum learning about the specimens that we have there.
Yeah, because like most people go to the museum and they see the specimens on display. They don't really see, actually, there's quite a lot going on in the background.
Absolutely. There's an entire world behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum that's on a daily basis being used to teach us about what's happened in the past and also allowing us to predict what might happen in the future.
Brilliant. So your background is actually in molecular biology.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
What is that? What were you studying and how does it apply to the work you're doing now?
Yeah, so my training is as something called a molecular systematist. And what that means is that we take DNA from different organisms, in my case, primarily amphibians and reptiles. We sequence their DNA, which when I was training was normally a gene or two genes. And then we compare those same genes and we use that to kind of help us try and figure out how they might be related to one another, how long it's been since they shared a common ancestor. So that's how my training started. But as I'm sure you've had other guests on this show that have talked about just how the age of genomics is upon us, and now we use DNA in so many ways that we never could have imagined we'd use it before. And so whereas before we were kind of using it to tell us how is species A related to species B, now we're using the same techniques that I learned to look at whole genomes and think about how genomes evolve through time, and also using it to help us test hypotheses about how physiology works in different animal groups. So we actually can take the RNA molecules that ultimately become proteins, and we can look at their content in different tissues now. That's how my training kind of relates to how I apply my training to what I do now, is using those techniques on amphibians and reptiles.
You see, so I assume that, you know, you're working with this huge collection of specimens. How much of the work that you're doing is this kind of DNA-based research, and how much of it is working on the specimens that exist in the museum?
Right, absolutely. I'd say that it's about 50-50. So any of the DNA data we collect, almost all the questions we have are about the whole organism. How has the whole organism changed? How are the tissues in the organism working? And so when we collect those DNA data, in order to interpret them, we have to look back at the whole specimen. So everything's done in context of the whole specimen. So I would say that, yeah, it's an integrative program where we use one couldn't exist without the other.
And how do you go about collecting those? I'm assuming that you don't have all specimens at the Natural History Museum. And so there must still be a role of going out and collecting specimens.
Sure, absolutely.
Is that something you still do now?
We do. So the section that I work in, we have active field programs. And so one of the great things about natural history museums, and particularly the Natural History Museum we have here, is that they have collections going back almost 200 years, and in our case, a little longer than 200 years. And so what's happened through time is that even though it wasn't the initial purpose of collecting and putting things in museums, over time we've created this series of sampling points at different points in time, and it creates this really unique opportunity in science where we can go back and at these different snapshots in time, we can see what was going on in that organism's world. And so to continue that and allow us to have increased ability to predict what might happen, not only to the animals that the species the specimens belong to, but also to what's going on in their environments, we continue to collect and put specimens in. And so where we go collect kind of depends a lot on what individual researchers are doing at the museum, but it is something we still actively do.
Cool. And so have you been on research trips out
there? Sure.
What kind of places do you to look for the animals that you're doing research on?
So we recently started a project that's exploring the evolution of frog and toad vision. And it's a really exciting project. It's in collaboration with the Smithsonian and a couple of universities in the U.S. And what we've been doing is created essentially an international network of collaborators. And so several of us have been going to where our collaborators live. We were in Ecuador this summer. Other members of the team are going to Australia and Brazil and places in Africa. And we've gone and we've done some field collections to not only look at what's going on in the eyes of the animals in the field, but then also be able to bring them in labs, ultimately make them specimens, and continue to get data out of them so that we can ask a lot of these questions that will help us understand them better.
Yeah, so I remember seeing something about frog vision a little while ago where there's some sort of movement basis where they can see things better if they're actually moving.
Right. Yeah, and the orientation of what they're looking at matters as well. If depending on the direction of the movement and the orientation of the object, it can determine whether or not at least toads that the experiments have been done on can see them. So that's definitely one aspect of amphibian vision research, but there aren't that many more of them, which is one of the reasons we're excited about this project. So we're actually going to get a more comprehensive idea of what's going on in the eye itself, because what you're talking about has a lot to do with how the eye interacts with the brain and what the animal can ultimately do behaviorally. What our research is going to be doing is focusing on the eye, looking at the anatomy of the eye, looking at the photoreceptors, the cells on the retina, looking at what's going on with their morphology, what their spectral absorbance is, like what types of light they respond to, and then also looking at the genes that are expressed in them. So the idea is that maybe when we have that understanding, we may know a lot more about why that movement is limiting for the toads.
And that's an example of this research going all the way through from a specimen to actually dissection, looking at the specimen.
Absolutely.
All the way through to the expression of the genes, right down on this molecular biology level.
And then that specimen is accessioned into the collections, and it stays there where it will hopefully serve a future purpose for someone else doing a project that we can't even imagine what it would be right now.
Right. Well, that's amazing. Let's go on to your second song. You've chosen Iron and Wine with Boy with a Coin. Was there any particular reason?
Yeah. So it's Saturday morning, and this is one of my favorite bands to listen to in the morning. I do a lot of scientific writing, and this is one of the few artists I can listen to, and I can just kind of get into a good headspace for writing. So that's why I've selected this one.
DNA technology is moving extremely fast. The first human genome took 13 years to sequence. This can now be done in just 26 hours.
Well, that's a big step up.
A big change.
That's amazing.
We live in a different world.
Exactly. The future is here. We were talking about before how you're using this kind of genomic data on this massive scale. What kind of questions can you now answer using this data?
Right. So I think... So some of the questions that we ask with it relate to some of my early training, which is that we can, I think, now really generate reasonable hypotheses about, you know, what species are, how species are related, because we have just a lot more statistical power, because we're not sampling one gene, we're not sampling two genes. In many cases, we're sampling hundreds or thousands of them. And in some cases, we're sampling tens of thousands of little variants all across the genome.
Right.
And so that's definitely changed the game in terms of how genetics contributes to our understanding of evolution. But it's also, I think, just as I was describing in the vision, the vision component before the last song, it's helping us to kind of make a connection between the genes that underlie a lot of the physical traits we see in animals, in plants, connect what's actually going on at the cellular level to what we see in the whole organism. And so, like the eye example I gave you would be another way that we're using it, not to build evolutionary trees, but to ask questions about gene expression in particular tissues.
So how the gene changes what happens in the animal, really. But this fundamental question of, like, the species, you know, what is a species? How do you classify it? Because that's a hard problem, right?
It is, yeah.
So, is a species? Can you even answer that?
I think it's a tricky question, right? And it's something that I don't think with bigger genome data sets is something that's become necessarily easier to answer because, you know, species are, as most professional evolutionary biologists recognize speciation as a continuous process, right? Speciation is going on all the time. It's happening right now while we sit in the studio, right?
This speciation is the formation of a distinct species.
Yeah. Precisely. Right now there are individuals and there are populations that are differentiating. And so any point in our planet's history, if you were to take a snapshot and look at all life on the planet, there would be some things that are incredibly well differentiated from one another and other things that are not. So it's easy to say those are not distinct species. Yeah. And some things where it's complicated, right? Where you've probably had a lot of diversification that either has related, it could relate to a number of things, to geographic distance between populations, to, novel morphological traits that have evolved, so novel features of the animal that have evolved. There are a lot of things that could explain why, differentiation is happening at that level.
Yeah, so I heard about one which was, so I don't know if it's quite speciation, but the different bird calls between birds that are in the UK that live in cities and in the countryside is different because there's a hum of noise in the city.
And that's a potential mechanism for speciation. So if you give this enough time or you have enough, isolation, you could make a reasonable argument that these are different species.
Yeah, and so what had happened was the hum of the noise meant that the birds that were living in the city couldn't hear each other.
Right.
So they made their calls at higher pitch so that they were kind of heard above the noise.
Right.
And now the birds in the city and the birds in the countryside can't really
Yeah, if they occur in the same environment, the same habitat, you have this mechanism that they won't reproduce with one another. So that's a great example. I think that in some cases, species are going to be arbitrary when you have kind of messy differentiation going on other places. Time's going to be easy to tell that. But these big genome data sets, or genomic scale, I should say, data sets, are making it easier for us to scrutinize hypotheses of what we might call species in a particular group.
And so you were specifically doing this work. You recently did some work with snakes where you were trying to divide them into different, and you call them clades.
Yes.
So what's a clade and how did you use that to kind of figure out which snakes go where?
So a clade is a term molecular systematists any systematists use to refer to a group of, it could be individuals, a group of species, a group of genera. It could be at any evolutionary level, right? But a group of things that you're looking at that share a common ancestor to the exclusion of anything else you're looking at. And so another way, if you think about evolution as a tree, right? If you think about it as a branching pattern through time, if you were to go, you see all the leaves at the very tip, if you were to go back further towards the trunk of the tree and you grabbed, a thick branch, essentially any of the branches that are connected to that thick branch that go to the leaves, that would be a clade, but it would have to include all of those.
Okay, so it's like a grouping and a common ancestor.
That's right. It's related to ancestry, and it creates a concept we call monophyly in systematics. And so with the snake paper that you're referring to, there are a lot of clades of snakes that we feel very confident about that, we can say these snakes share a common ancestor. And an example would be the family Boidae, which as you may guess from the name is like boa constrictors and things like that. If I brought five different species that are in that family together, and then I brought a random 30 or 40 different snakes from elsewhere in the snake tree, I bet you could say all of these snakes belong together without just looking at their kind of general physical shape. So some groups of snakes we know a lot about in terms and have good evidence that they are a clade, right? Both from the physical features or what we call morphology, and then also the DNA that corroborates that backs that up. But deeper back in the snake tree of life, there are some of these branches I was talking about that have been very difficult to figure out, or we've gotten conflicting results depending on what type of data we collect and apply to the problem. So in that paper, we were using one of these new methods that lets us look all over the genome and see what that data set told us about how different families of snake might be related to one another.
So you were able to use this massive data of lots of genomic data and process it in a way that you could kind of reclassify snakes and clarify a bit who evolved from whom.
Or at least have a hypothesis that has some statistical support values associated with it. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so we're going to move on to your next song.
All right.
You've chosen Metric with Gold Guns Girls. Why did you choose Metric?
So Metric is a band that I was listening to a lot in the mid to late aughts, and this is off, I think, their album Fantasies. And I think it's another one that I really like to have on in the background when I'm working on, say, like putting in accession numbers into a table or something like that. It just makes it a lot easier to stay focused and get to the end of the table.
So something character building.
Yeah, and this is just a great example of one of their more kind of rock and roll tracks.
Reptiles are vertebrates which exhibit temperature-dependent sex determination.
So we were arguing actually earlier about whether they're the only animals.
Right.
And we're not quite sure. We're not quite sure. So we're just
going to look that up.
We're going to have to put that down. So they are animals that are determined by that.
Yeah, it does happen in many of them.
It does happen. So we've been talking about the kind of basic research that you're doing at the Natural History Museum, but really that's only half your job because you're involved with the outward-facing aspect of the museum as well. How do you get involved with that?
One big part of the job of most curators at the museum is to engage. We have a public engagement group at the Natural History Museum, and so we spend a lot of time helping them to develop science content that's both going to be presented in at events. Like we have a Lates event that we run most months.
The Lates is really good.
It's a lot of fun. If you're in London and you're here at the, I think it's the last Friday of any given month, I encourage you to come out. So we help develop content for those style events, and then we also develop content that's going to be on both temporary and permanent exhibitions with them.
Right. Okay. So you're developing stuff. You're actually picking specimens. You're talking about what they're doing, or like how involved are you, or do you just, you know, we'd like to present a bit of this, do you then go into the banks and be like, so this is what we want to put
definitely
on display,
it's or? Definitely a collaboration in the sense that we kind of have, you know, they'll normally come to us with a general idea of here's a theme that we're going to be creating an exhibition around. Given your specialist knowledge of your group, do you have any specimens that might be relevant for that? And so we kind of explore different narratives that might be relevant for, say, example, we have one opening very soon called Venom, and that there are lots of reptiles, you know, that are venomous. So there are a lot of are snakes that are going to be featured in that.
I work at Imperial. The big snake poster. It says venom, the large snake. I'm sure that's
the mangrove
yours.
Snake. Yeah. That's right.
He's on there, definitely.
Rear-fanged snake. Yeah. And then, yeah, so it's related to kind of identifying what's appropriate for whatever the particular exhibition is going to be, and then helping develop how do we make that as clear as we can in terms of the writing of, you know, information that's going to be displayed with the specimen,
right, yeah.
And also for advertising content, saying, you know, to try and communicate what our general message is, because I think there's definitely an entertainment side to the exhibitions, but the main goal, of course, is to communicate science and to really try and make sure that people understand what we're doing at the Natural History Museum is related to continuing to understand the natural world better.
Yeah. Is there something that you've got kind of hidden back in the back of the museum that if given the chance, you'd really want to put on display?
Hundreds of thousands of things.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's... I could try to make a compelling argument for any, if we went to the herpetology collection stores and we opened any random cupboard, I feel like we could make a really compelling argument for why any of the specimens are interesting, because they all, you know, all of these organisms have these incredible, not only natural histories, how they survive and interact with their environments, but also this incredible, evolutionary heritage, where they came from, who their relatives are, what made them look like they do. And then there's also, I think, the thing that we're trying to do a lot more of is make not just the, I mean, there's a lot of discovery in what I'm talking about, right? Mm. Knowing things for the sake of knowing them. But we're also increasingly trying to talk a lot more about what the applied importance of our knowledge of these different species is. And so understanding why, say, you know, some species of python evolved to be able to grow their organs to rapidly consume food and things like that,
yeah.
and essentially survive having levels of, hormones in their blood that would kill a human, like insulin, for example. How they evolved to do that can really maybe have some applications towards us dealing with human disease and things like that. So I think I think it'd be tough to say that there's a particular thing I'd like to share with the public, other than there's a lot of information and knowledge contained behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So we're gonna have to move on to your next song.
Sure.
So we're gonna have "Time to Stain" by He Is Legend. What do you like about He Is Legend?
So He Is Legend is one of my favorite bands. They're a heavier band, and they're quite dynamic. If you listen to their whole catalog, they've got a really dynamic range of music that most heavy bands don't. So that's why I selected them.
Color change is caused by its emotion, as well as light and temperature. It does not change because of its background.
Science
news.
Etna ended the Ptolemaic dynasty.
Can we engineer our weather?
Fossil cat DNA obtained.
AlphaGo ditches human input.
Our insects may be dying out.
Flowers converge to attract bees.
All right, so I'm sorry, I really need to hear about this cat, because that is super cool. This is fossilized cat DNA has been recovered?
That's right. So this week in Current Biology, a German-led team has using ancient DNA techniques, has sequenced a partial mitochondrial genome from a really interesting saber-toothed cat fossil. And this is a saber-toothed cat in the genus Homo Therium. And they got this DNA sequence, and using that, they were able to compare it to a couple of other fossil DNA sequences from classic saber-toothed cats like Smilodon, and determined how the new fossil and the Smilodon fossils are related, there's as much genetic divergence between them, or there's more genetic divergence between them than we see between a house cat and a tiger. So just saying that they were very distant relatives is what the hypothesis would be after this research.
There's maybe a lot more kind of evolutionary distance than people thought.
That's what the research would suggest.
It's amazing that they can get DNA from that far back. How much of these kind of ancient DNA techniques come on? Now you can actually get things from things that have been fossilized for quite some
time. Yeah, absolutely. And it really has to do with these newer sequencing technologies that utilize smaller pieces of DNA than we used to, say 10 years ago. And I mean, we still use these DNA sequencing methods where you select big pieces of the gene. But the newer methods use these tiny pieces of DNA. And that's really ideal for when you're working with, say, fossils or museum specimens, where the DNA over time degrades.
Right. So it doesn't stay in there forever.
There's a lot of DNA sequencing technology in there, but also a lot of luck they get into the bone, and that there's some DNA that survived the test of time.
Okay, so Miriam, you've got something about insects, and they might be dying out, which is probably quite bad for us humans, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So a study in Germany has reported that in the last 27 years, numbers of bees, wasps, midges, and other insects have declined substantially. So in fact, the planet could be facing its sixth mass extinction. Samples of insects collected from nature reserves throughout Germany show a decline in the populations of numerous species of insects by as much as 82%. percent since 1989. It is unsure what the cause is or if this is happening in other parts of the world. However, it is suspected that modern agricultural techniques, and in particular the use of pesticides, may be the culprits. So this is extremely worrying, as insects are a vital part of our ecosystem, as well as providing food for other animals such as amphibians, birds and mammals, which may also become extinct if there are no insects to feed on. They are extremely important in the breakdown and disposal of waste products in our environment.
Yeah, they're really quite big. And so the bees is quite important. And I know that they've actually now isolated what they think is the cause of this bee colony, spontaneous colony collapse, which has been happening recently. And it is a pesticide. Mm-hmm. And it's a build-up in the pesticide of the inside the bee of this pesticide that causes them to. And there was something, I can't remember if it was Einstein who said that. If all the bees disappeared, he gives the human race 8 years or something like that.
Oh my God.
The ability to survive, because they do so much pollination, right. And all of our food is basically pollinated by bees and things like that. So quite important.
Yes.
Okay. So I've got a really cool thing that I think will be enjoyed by some of our listeners about Etna and it ending the Ptolemaic dynasty. So this is idea that this historian Joseph Manning has tried to, he found a link between the eruptions of Etna and periods of kind of social unrest and violence, like revolts and things like that. Mm. And so what he did was have a look at the record of large eruptions in the Iceland green sheets in Antarctica, because when volcanoes erupt, the dust settles and it actually goes into ice cores, which you can then look back in time and see when certain eruptions occurred. And those eruptions actually correlate with periods of weakened monsoons in the areas that feed the Nile. And so what happens is the dust shifts around what's called the intertropical convergence zone, and that's responsible for the monsoon rains. That means there is not as many floods in the Nile Valley, and then that leads to poor harvests and social unrest. And so the thinking is that this social unrest is actually a contributing factor for the end of the Ptolemaic dynasty, when Cleopatra died in 30 BCE. This is quite a reach, but you're saying, okay, so this volcanic eruption had an effect on the society that existed at the time. And I mean, this is quite important. Obviously, these social changes these climatic changes really have social, you know, effects, yeah. which is quite
Seems
amazing.
Reasonable that they could, yeah.
Yeah, so Miriam, on that note, you've said you've got something where we can engineer our weather to hopefully mitigate against this, right?
Well, so everyone knows that our planet is heating up at an alarming rate. And while recycling and trying to cut down on the fossil fuels that we burn can help reduce this, a new method of geoengineering, which is a technique where we can control our weather patterns. Scientists at the University of Bedfordshire believe that by releasing sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere, we may be able to reflect some of the sun's rays and radiation back into space. So it is expected that this would help reduce the rate at which the planet is heating up. They have been using computer models to convincingly predict that this would significantly reduce the temperature of the sea surface by the year 2069. So there is a concern, however, that releasing these particles into the atmosphere may drastically alter regional weather patterns, something which the planet's animals and planets depend upon. So much more investigation is obviously needed in this field, but watch this space.
Yeah, so you're saying to reduce the sea surface temperature, and that was quite a contributing factor in the hurricanes recently. Mm-hmm. Apparently, the sea, because the sea was quite warm, that contributes or gives energy to the hurricanes, and this makes them more and more intense. Mm-hmm. So even small temperatures in small changes in sea temperature can actually have a massive effect on massive storms that can hit the coast of the United States and even in Ireland. Not that long ago. So, Jeff, you also got something about the structure of plants. This is something I've heard about recently. What was going on here?
Right. So, yeah, in Nature this week, there's a paper that's been published that provides some compelling evidence that multiple lineages of flowering plant have converged on using structural color to attract bees. And so what's going on here is a really interesting story, where blue is a difficult color, is a rare color to see in nature, to see the pigment blue. It's difficult to make, is the prevailing hypothesis. And so what this study is looking at is that kind of at the nanoscale, there's a structural coloring going on that gives these flowers the appearance of blue, so that they're more attractive to bees whose vision is more... it allows them to see blue colors quite
it's
well.
It's more sensitive in the UV, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it's moving. Yeah, exactly. So that they're emitting UV. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's I can't. Reflecting UV. There is another one, but one is forget-me-nots, and I think there's only one other plant that's like a really true blue plant.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's quite rare, but yeah. This particular thing they talk about seems to be it's spread throughout angiosperms, the flowering plants. So it seems like it's a successful strategy.
Wow. So the last bit of news we've got today is I've got something about AlphaGo. AlphaGo has ditched human input. And so AlphaGo is this AI that's been developed by the team at DeepMind. And they've developed AlphaGo Zero. And this is a artificial intelligence that taught itself to play Go without the intervention of a human. And so the older version of AlphaGo, called AlphaGo Lee, used games played by human experts to develop its strategy. And that was the AI that beat a human player for the first time. But now they've got a new version that just played games against itself to develop its strategy. Oh, wow. And apparently it took a few days to play 4.9 million games and then proceeded to beat AlphaGo Lee 100 games to none. And so it's just got so much better. It's discovered tactics that over the 1,000 years humans have developed. It's also discovered other tactics that no one knew anything about. This is amazing because this is a computer teaching itself a task from scratch. So this is another massive step in a computer. Computers actually actively learning rather than being taught to do a specific task. They're
machine
actively
learning, yeah.
Like finding things out on their own, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
Okay, right. We're gonna have to move on to the next song. You've chosen Chaos by Mute Math.
Yes.
Why this?
I really like the drummer in this band. That's the only explanation I have.
That's a good reason.
Researchers estimated that the half-life of DNA is 521 years, meaning that it would take approximately 6.8 billion years for all the bonds in a DNA molecule to be broken.
Yes, this is what we were just talking about before. Like, there's a bit of a half-life on it. You have to get it soon, but it's that 6.8 billion years is quite a long time.
I'm definitely going to read more about that.
Yeah, there might be
learned something very important today.
So, Jeff, the direction of research we were talking about is kind of directing more towards big data and this analysis of the huge amount of genome data you can now get. There's always going to be a space for real specimens, and why is that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, like I mentioned earlier, it's not only because you have to relate what you see in the genomes back to the specimens themselves, but it's also because genomes and genetics is just one line of evidence when you're interested in, thinking about and asking questions related to evolution. And it's not the only way technology is helping us understand our specimens better. We do a lot of imaging at the at the museum, and so one of the things we do is micro CT scanning. And we actually can now, using a technique that's been developed in the last 5 to 10 years, we can get we can scan a whole specimen. We don't have to cut into it. We don't have to dissect it. And we can look at tissues. We can look at its nervous system. We can look at its stomach contents. We can look at all of these different things non-destructively, right?
Right.
And we can also we can digitally take them out, so we can look at volumes and things like that. And so it's really just opening up a whole new way to avoid some of the biases associated with classic dissection and things like that. So in that regard, we'll, as that technology gets better, we will use the specimens even more, I think. And then we're also getting much better at using these specimens as indicators of their environment. So I talked about how the museum specimens kind of present this unique opportunity for us to look back in the past and actually take data. And that's really rare to go back and say, I want to collect empirical data from 60 years ago. It's very rare to have that in science. Usually you're predicting into what happened in the past with models. And so what we can do now with stable isotope analysis, we're starting to actually be able to get a picture of what's going on in environments at different points in time. And as that technology gets better, where we can use it with our specimens more, again, I think the relevance is only going to increase.
Yeah, it's interesting you say you have this kind of environmental factors, and so these specimens are a good way of kind of testing the environment of the animals living, and we can see Absolutely. Whether things are getting worse or better right. in certain.
You can determine where they're from, and then the specimen. At least with the specimens I work with, you have to keep in mind it's not just them that's preserved; it's also the last thing they ate, the last thing that they ate, you know, and yeah. so on and so forth. So it really captures not only the ecosystem at the molecular level, but also in terms of the you know species that are existing in the ecosystem at that point in time.
Yeah, that's really. And I was there is a kind of a bit of a concern at the moment with these. Finely balanced environments
right.
that there is a decline in some of these animals. Is it right to say that amphibians are actually being subject to quite a strong decline at the moment?
Absolutely. For the last several decades, we've kind of unfortunately been documenting a trend that many species of amphibians have been in decline or gone extinct. And it's something that is we're still getting a handle on. We know that there's a lot of contribution from this fungal disease that's it's called chytrid fungus that's spread around. It seems to have been human mediated. It's spread around the world. We also know habitat modification is something that's contributed to a lot of local extirpations, you know, species being, you know, they can't live where there's concrete if you desiccate in the sun. And then, of course, you know, changing weather patterns associated with climate change also can, you know, have been implicated in causing some of these declines. That is unfortunate. We're using museum collections to try and understand this, though, because not all amphibian species have declined. And so we're actually looking at those that have persisted. And thanks to museum collections and us being able to having collected them continuously through time, we can look at the species that have survived a lot of these threats and ask what's different about them from those that we've unfortunately lost.
Brilliant. So there's definitely hope there.
Agreed.
We're getting to the end of the show, unfortunately. So, Miriam, we're going to ask, what was the answer to our question at the top?
So the brain teaser this morning was, what family does an axolotl belong to? So we had some tweets in, and Charlie, who was actually in the studio a few shows ago, so hello, Charlie, he said that it belongs to the Ambystomatidae family.
Did he Google that?
if he had knowledge, then that is great knowledge. Yeah. I got as close as, it's like a kind of salamander, right?
It is. It's a caudate. Yes.
There we go. Yeah. Oh, caudate. There we go. Well, thank you, Jeff, for that insight into the world of a curator. How can people get in touch with you or find out more? Do you have a Twitter handle that people follow?
I do. I'm on Twitter, and you can also get a hold of me via the Natural History Museum's website.
Brilliant. Thank you, Miriam. And you've been listening to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. If you like the show, get in touch with us on social media. We're at Science Mixtape on Twitter. If you're listening to the podcast version of the show, why not mention it to a friend who might enjoy it? In this age of the internet, you know, personal recommendations still very important. You can also comment and like and do all the other things. We just have time for Jeff's last song. You've chosen Rush with Snakes and Arrows. Why did you choose this?
So I picked this this song because one of my my best friends and collaborators is a big Rush fan. We've written a lot of papers about snakes together, and I think about herpetology because this album Rush put out has a herpetological title, Snakes and Arrows.
Well, thank you and goodbye.